The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic. But before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Now, on today's Armchair Traveler, we're going to explore the curious case of the tigers who changed their stripes. Now, Prasenjit Yadav's article appears in the October 2025 issue of National Geographic. As a photo caption explains, a century ago, India's tigers were on the brink of extinction. Slowly, their numbers have rebounded. But that ecological success has prompted a dire new problem and a race to save many of them from genetic collapse. Now let's go to the story. It took 50 days of searching before the jungle revealed its biggest secret to us. 50 days of jostling along gravel roads in the Samillipal Tiger Reserve in India's eastern state of Odisha, scanning between trees in the semi-evergreen forest, hoping for a glimpse of an elusive tiger called T12, whose striking appearance has made him a symbol of a population at a perilous crossroads. My partner in the quest, Raghu Perte, is a staffer with the Regional Forest Department. He'd never set eyes on T12. Most of his colleagues had only seen the tiger in images from camera traps set up to study animal movements throughout the reserve. But actually laying eyes on Samillipal's tigers lets forest officials look for physical ailments that cameras may not capture, and also provides a reminder that there's a living, breathing purpose to the countless hours they spend patrolling in the sweltering heat. A documented sighting of T12 would be particularly valuable, since the reclusive 10-year-old tiger, the eldest male in the Samillipal, was right then at the heart of a plan to ensure the survival of future generations. It was late in the afternoon of day 50 when, in the blink of an eye, a dark shape dashed out in front of our pickup truck. I slammed on the brakes. Ahead of us, spanning the width of the road, an enormous tiger stared back at Raghu and me. It was an older male, clear from its size, and it had exactly the strange, distinctive coat we'd been looking for. "It's black," Raghu said, in an insistent whisper. He pointed excitedly and repeated himself, "It's black." The tiger, T12, had dark fur that draped over him like a ragged cloak. Slivers of orange peeked through along his body, with thicker patches appearing on his face and front legs. This uncanny widening of a tiger's black stripes, a rare genetic mutation known as pseudomelanism, is shared among roughly half the tigers, 30 or so tigers, I should say, that roam the Samillipal Reserve. And it's an indicator of a conservation success story facing a potentially catastrophic complication. Because while the number of tigers in Samillipal is more robust than it has been in decades, the reserve is geographically isolated from other tiger populations, a tiger island, so to speak, with a dangerously dwindling gene pool. But during the weeks that Raghu and I scoured the area for T12, work was underway elsewhere to find him a suitable mate. It was a crucial step in a targeted breeding program that had been years in development, a mission shared between conservation agents and a team of groundbreaking molecular ecologists and genetic experts, all working to save the tigers of Samillipal from inbreeding themselves out of existence. In many ways, India's tigers have faced the same challenges as big cats throughout the world have, hunted to near extinction by trophy hunters amid relentless habitat destruction and fragmentation. In the 1970s, alarm over the iconic species decline prompted the establishment of a state-run reserve system. But the reserves lacked coordinated monitoring and enforcement until 2005, when India created a dedicated central agency, the National Tiger Conservation Authority, also NTCA, which today hires and trains rangers, manages scientific oversight, and guides habitat preservation across 58 reserves. A key concept underlying the reserve system is that tigers are typically able to travel between protected areas using what are known as natural corridors, patches of connecting forests and other prey-abundant lands. There are a number of benefits to these corridors, but the most important is that they encourage breeding among neighboring tiger populations, improving genetic diversity. Samelipal, at a little over 1,000 square miles, is one of India's largest reserves, and its closest neighboring ones, Satkosha to the southwest and Sundarban to the east, are both more than 100 miles away, which isn't too far for a tiger to walk. But there are no tigers left in Satkosha, and no adequate corridor connects Samelipal and Sundarban. Now, the land between them is mostly urban or agricultural. Kolkata, its suburbs and a vast area of rice fields with very little forest cover, which is where tigers prefer to stay hidden. Dozens of towns and villages separate Samelipal from its two neighboring reserves as well. For tigers, there is just no easy way in or out of Samelipal. When the NTCA surveyed wild tigers across India in 2006, the tally was roughly 1,400 animals, down from an estimated 40,000 a century before. In Samelipal, the population bottomed out at just four tigers. In 2014, only one of them was male. But in 2015, a year or so before he died, the male fathered T12 with his strange, predominantly black coat. And T12 has since fathered male cubs of his own. India's tiger population has begun to rebound over the past 20 years, thanks in large part to the conservation work of the NTCA and forest officials. As of 2022, in an estimate, the country is home to more than 3,100 tigers. And they face a task of trying to look at Samelipal's population because it's climbed slowly but steadily over the past decade. The growing number of tigers at first seemed like a microcosm of the national success story, but the reserve's managers began noticing more and more young tigers sporting the same dark coat as T12. The mutation, as far as both for foresters and genetic scientists can tell, is harmless, merely a cosmetic oddity caused by a random and naturally occurring quirk of DNA. But experts say it's also a tangible manifestation of a very real problem. If this mutation was able to pass so quickly through Samelipal's population, with all the tigers sharing very similar genetic makeup due to random or rampant inbreeding, then so too could more serious abnormalities. Now the task facing some of India's foremost tiger authorities has shifted from recovering tiger numbers to breaking this cycle of inbreeding before it's too late. Playing genetic matchmaker for tigers is tricky. In order to find the ideal breeding partners for T12 and his offspring, the would-be saviors of Samelipal needed to understand the differences among not only the tigers that roam today, but also the tigers of the past. That's what led molecular ecologist Uma Ramakrishnan, not long ago, into a dimly lit trophy room in a grand home in Akatara, a small town in central India. Ramakrishnan, National Geographic Explorer and the head of a lab at Bengaluru's National Center for Biological Sciences, that's also Bangalore in English, was invited there by Anupam Singh Sisodia, whose family had once held the role of chieftains across 51 villages and the surrounding forest and farmland, responsible for protecting the locals from dangerous wildlife. His family had done its share of hunting, and the room was full of mounted black bucks, sloth bears, and four-horned antelope collected between 1920 and 1970. But laid out on a table before Ramakrishnan was a set of tiger pelts, their massive heads intact and seemingly snarling. Killing the problematic tigers, Sisodia acknowledged, was more of a politically necessity than a pleasure. Since 2005, Ramakrishnan and her fellow researchers and students at the lab have been collecting samples of tiger DNA in order to build an extensive genetic map of the diversity among India's tigers. She secured roughly 250 specimens from historic estates like the Sisodias, and she has plumbed taxidermy collections at sites like the Natural History Museum in London and ventured into Indian jungles to procure scat, blood, hair, and saliva from live tigers. All that evidence has given her critical insight into how the animals have changed over generations as they moved throughout the region. Closely inspecting one of the tiger heads, Ramakrishnan slid her scalpel into the 80-something-year-old pelt. Practiced and precise, she sliced off a small piece, and she slid the sample into a vial and held it up. "This is the real treasure," she said. When Ramakrishnan first began building her DNA database, her goal was to answer questions about tigers that couldn't be answered by observing them in the field. As their population was decimated, tigers lost not only their territory, but also substantial genetic diversity. Historical DNA offered important clues about what else might exist within the gene pool. Her research became ever more relevant in 2017 when the NTCA, alarmed by the dark-coated tigers in Samelipal, asked her to formally study the reserve's tigers. The forest officials clearly saw that the impacts of the reserve's population were becoming measurable. They hoped Ramakrishnan could both verify the genetic culprit and help them find a solution. Once she took a closer look at the animals sequestered within the reserve, Ramakrishnan quickly realized that the recessive pseudomelanism gene was spreading through the population. The genetic isolation on display, she said, was a ticking time bomb. Left unaddressed, it could prove devastating to the reserve's tigers. It's impossible to know precisely what other maladies genetic mutations among big cats might introduce. But when Ramakrishnan and her colleagues analyzed a genetic mutation data set for the closest available comparison, domestic cats, they found that these not-so-distant cousins faced issues like retinal atrophy, kidney disease, and hyperthyroidism. And with female tigers averaging litters of 2 to 3 cubs every 2 to 3 years, health issues can quickly and dramatically compound. "We're still trying to understand the full impact of this inbreeding," she says, "but one thing's for sure, there's no upside to this kind of genetic erosion. Given Samelipal's lack of connection to other reserves..." Ramakrishnan's recommendation was that wildlife managers identify a few tigers from a separate reserve and translocate them. Once in Samelipal, the tigresses, the forest managers elected to move females, would hopefully reproduce with T12 or with his male offspring, which would have begun to claim pieces of T12's territory as they mature and have cubs of their own. This, Ramakrishnan said, would begin the overdue effort to diversify the reserve's genetic pool. By comparing Samelipal tiger DNA to the array of records in her data set, she found that the most genetically diverse tigers with the lowest chance of more negative genes showing up in any future offsprings were located in a reserve called Tadoba Andhari in the dense teak forest of the district of Chandipur, halfway across India. Of course, Ramakrishnan knew that identifying the right reserve is one thing, but actually moving a 300-pound wild animal hundreds of miles across the country, well, that's another thing. One morning last fall, Robert Kant Kukbradigade stood up in front of from his spot in the open-air backseat of a 2-door Maruti Gypsy and looked out onto the Chandipur landscape. The wildlife veterinarian turned his attention to his ace shooter, A.J. Marathe, who was cradling a tranquilizer gun and gestured to a young tigress just up ahead. "I can see her. She is sitting in that bush looking at us," Kobrabrati said. The tigress, later named Jamuna, was 28 years old and had spent her life in or near the Tadoba Reserve. Her youth meant she hadn't yet established territory there, and crucially, she had no history of conflict with humans. Both of these things made her a prime translocation candidate. Translocation work, particularly for animals as large and territorial as tigers, is highly sensitive under any circumstances, and in India's tiger reserves, it requires a large number of verifications and approvals before it can proceed. High on the list of considerations is whether an area identified as having candidates has a population healthy enough to withstand losing breeding age females. In Tadoba, this is not a concern. Although the reserve is 2/3 the size of Samelipal, it is home to roughly 95 tigers, and so it is no tiger island. Natural corridors connect Tadoba to the Umred Karhandla, Wildlife Sanctuary, around 40 miles to the north, and the Nawagon Nagzira Tiger Reserve, 70 miles to the northeast, and the Kowal Tiger Reserve, 70 miles to the southwest. Tadoba's tigers regularly venture out in search of more forested space, and as their numbers have swelled over the past decade, all that movement has meant that tigers and people in the surrounding mosaic of forest, villages, and farmlands have had to learn how to live alongside one another again. Most important for T-12 and his kin, the network of connected reserves has allowed for a constant exchange of tiger genes. Jamuna would be the first of two Tadoba tigers translocated to the Samelipal in a matter of weeks, with others to potentially follow in the coming months and years if the experiment went well. But first, she needed to be sedated. "Is that dart ready, sir?" asked Marathi. Well, the tigress rose from her spot in the bush and marched closer to their vehicle. When she was around 5 yards away, Marathi calmly removed the safety key from his dart gun, brought the scope to his eye, and took the shot. The pink-tailed projectile landed in Jamuna's thigh, prompting a loud growl that echoed across the landscape as she bounded away. She made it about 200 yards before the tranquilizer took its toll. The team found her laid out in a meadow. It took 7 men to carefully slide Jamuna onto a stretcher and then move her into the shade. Cobra Gade checked her for injuries and drew a blood sample. After he fixed a GPS collar around her neck, the team moved her into a metal cage aboard a truck. Once safely inside, Jamuna was given a revival drug. Within minutes, the men heard rustling and banging, the sound of her nails scratching against metal, followed by a roar. The road trip to deliver Jamuna to Samelipal took 28 hours. The truck was joined by a small convoy of support staff. The route had been carefully mapped to circumvent major cities and other areas where loud noises could cause Jamuna distress. Every few hours, the vehicles pulled over for a while to allow her to rest. Finally, the door opened, and Jamuna leaped through the gate, leading into her new home, a 2.5-acre enclosure in Samelipal, where she spent almost 2 weeks acclimating. After that, the gate opened once more, and this time, with no cage on the other side, she was set free into the territory of T-12. When it comes to restoring diversity among India's wild tigers, one critical step remains solely under nature's control: mating. And tigers engage in selective courtships before they breed. So in November, less than a month after Jamuna was released into the reserve, a second female tiger from Tadoba called Zeenat was sedated and transferred to an enclosure in Samelipal. Whereas Jamuna settled into the Samelipal landscape with relative ease, the stress of the relocation took a greater toll on Zeenat, and she quickly wandered beyond the reserve's borders. The Forest Department, not wanting her to stray too far, sent a team out to tranquilize her and bring her back to spend several more weeks in an enclosure to acclimate before she was released into T-12's territory. Both she and Jamuna wore GPS collars so that forest officials could track their movement and behavior. Knowing where the tigers were, forest officers on the ground used night vision cameras to observe them from a safe distance. They kept a close eye on the pair to see whether either of them would cross paths with T-12 or other males. But the observers only saw Jamuna and Zeenat alone. Tiger courtship, by contrast, is conspicuous. A pair of mating tigers might spend weeks together walking through the forest and vocalizing. Yet, as the tigresses established territory in Samelipal, forest officials never saw any evidence they'd so much as had contact with T-12. Until one night in May, reviewing the feed from a mounted camera that takes thermal and visual images, the Forest Department captured footage of Zeenat with T-12. It was unmistakable evidence. Their mating ritual had begun. The courtship sighting signaled that the genetic rescue mission, if not yet an outright success, holds promise. Meanwhile, this summer, as the teams behind the translocation await Zeenat's first litter of cubs, the work continued. Ramakrishnan and her students collected more hair and scat samples left behind by Samelipal tigers to better understand the genetic variation within the population. Officials are hopeful that Jamuna will eventually find a mate, and everyone working in Samelipal is eager to see whether Zeenat's cubs are born with T-12's pseudomelanism. It's not yet decided whether or when the reserve will receive more translocated tigresses, or how many there might be needed to introduce sufficient genetic variability. But until a corridor links Semilipal to other populated tiger reserves, more translocations could be the only viable option. Looking ahead, Semilipal Field Director Prakash Chan Goganini said his personal hope is that Semilipal's tigers can become a source population that helps return the species to places like the nearby Sekosha Reserve. That might happen with the help of a translocated Semilipal tigress, or perhaps via new corridors, even if the latter are still likely decades away. Witnessing all of this firsthand, seeing the pitfalls that India's tigers face as they begin to make their comeback, returns me to certain moments from my childhood. I grew up on a farm not far from Chandipur, where my life revolved around animals and jungles, for better or worse. Naming pet dogs was painful, as leopards regularly took them away, and every now and then we would encounter a pug mark similar to a leopard's but much bigger. The air would fill with fear and excitement at the realization we were sharing space with a true apex predator. The experience of living alongside something that powerful and elusive shaped how I saw the forest and my place within it. I never came across a tiger at our farm, but I often dreamed of it. In the years since, I have seen, studied, and photographed countless tigers, but none of them looked like what I saw the day in Semilipal while sitting in the idling truck with Raghu. Locked in a momentary staring contest with T-12, I didn't reach for my camera. I didn't move. There stood a black tiger, a testament to humans' best intentions gone wrong. In the best-case scenario for Semilipal, this will one day be a rare and unforgettable creature. One that inspired a new discipline for safeguarding the species. In that moment, for 4 seconds on the roadway, it felt like a miracle of nature. Then, without a roar or snarl, T-12 took a few powerful strides and then vanished into the thick evergreen forest. I suspect, my friends, we'll be hearing more about T-12 in future episodes of Armchair Travel. We'll have to see. Well, from translocating tigers in India's tiger reserve, let's change themes as we read, Can We Save the Orbiting Treasures of the Space Race? Now, Brian Kevin's article appears in the October 2025 issue of National Geographic, and it's quite an interesting article, as you will hear. So here we go. As human-made objects proliferate in space, a coalition of scientists and historians have floated retrieving some of the most important. In one view, Vanguard 1 is space junk, an antennaed aluminum ball that Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev dismissively compared to a grapefruit. The United States launched it in March 1958, and the satellite returned radio signals until May 1964. Defunct since, it's the oldest human-made object in the orbit. Now, to space historian Matt Bell, that grapefruit is one of the most precious objects of the early space age, deserving of a place in the Smithsonian, and scientists, he says, could glean much from it about long-term exposure to space. Bill, along with a few like-minded engineers and historians, made this case at a recent conference of the American Institute of Astronautics and Aeronautics, presenting detailed plans for a hypothetical mission to decorate Vanguard 1 and bring it home. The idea has turned heads, not least for challenging the preference for in situ preservation that's increasingly enshrined in heritage fields, including the burgeoning discipline of space archaeology. Old satellites need to be left where they are, says Alice Gorman, who sits on the International Council on Monuments and Sites Aerospace Committee. They're safer in orbit, she says, where they belong to no one nation and can be studied via photography and other remote sensing methods. But space is getting crowded, Bill notes. More than 14,000 satellites orbit the Earth, to say nothing of debris. He and his co-authors framed their technical paper as a thought experiment. Should we ever consider nabbing historically significant satellites, which might merit consideration? They offer 11 candidates, each a national first or a pioneering mission, and all conceivably retrievable. Bill says, if one dreams big, it can happen. Well, what are they talking about when it comes to that? Well, we have, accompanying Brian Kevin's article, a three-page graphic displaying some of the more historic satellites that continue to orbit the Earth. And we're going to try to give you a quick, brief snapshot of some of these. We start with Vanguard 1, launched by the U.S. on March 17th, 1958, in low Earth orbit. The second U.S. satellite in orbit, the first Explorer 1, burned up upon reentry in 1970. Its most distinguished contribution was to confirm via variations in its orbit that Earth was less round than supposed, bulging around the equator. Then we have Pioneer 4, launched by the U.S. March 3, 1959, solar orbit. Like Luna 1, the first American craft to travel beyond Earth's orbit also blew its objective, passing too far from the moon to photograph it as planned. It returned good data, though, on the Earth's encircling radiation belts. Now, Luna 1, launched by the USSR, and that was January 2, 1959, in a solar orbit, a yoga ball to Vanguard 1's Grapefruit and the first spacecraft to escape Earth's gravity. The Soviets aimed for the moon and missed by some 3,700 miles. Luna 1 became instead the first spacecraft to settle into orbit around the sun. Then we have Tyros 1, launched by the U.S. on April 1, 1960 in low Earth orbit. Today we take weather observation satellites for granted, but when NASA sent up its first attempt at one, a flying lady's hat box, as one newsreel called Tyros 1. Just how useful it would be for forecasting was still an open question. And now there are dozens of those satellites that give us our daily weather forecast. Now, let's move on to Alouette 1, launched by Canada September 29, 1962. This was a low Earth orbit. Canada became the third nation in space with this workhorse, which sent back some 2 million data snapshots of the ionosphere, the atmospheric layer that reflects radio waves, during a record-setting 10 years operation. Then we have Telstar. You probably remember some of the music that was made about Telstar. The U.S. launched this one July 10, 1962, again in low Earth orbit. The first ever active communication satellite sporadically relayed TV images across the Atlantic until, as space historian Matt Brill puts it, we sort of killed it by accident. Radiation from a high altitude nuclear test knocked it out for 7 months. Then there was a satellite called Asterix, launched by France, November 26, 1965, again in low Earth orbit, France's first foray into orbit, and the first satellite named for a comic book character, a pint-sized ghoulish warrior. And it's damaged upon ejection from its rocket and transmitted no or next to no data. So it didn't really have much of a chance, did it? So there you go. And then we have Vela 1A and B, launched by the U.S. October 17, 1963, in a high Earth orbit. And from Spanish Velar to Watch, this pair of polyhedrons went up weeks after the U.S. ratified the Limited Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, designed to detect nuclear explosions and work together to triangulate their location. Now, some of the others, we only have a few seconds left before we have to close, so I'll just read these. Early Bird went up in April 6, 1965. It's in a geostationary orbit. Pioneer 6, December 16, 1965. Solar orbit. And finally, Vega, USSR. And that went up December 15, 1984 in a solar orbit. So lots of things floating around up there, just so you know. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Armchair Traveler, and we certainly hope you've enjoyed today's episode and that you'll join us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of the program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.